This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. For 25 years, doctors Joseph McCormick and Susan Fisher Hawk have been tracking and studying the most deadly of viruses: Ebola, Lassa fever, Hanta, Crimean Congo hemorrhagic fever, and AIDS. Their work has taken them to villages in Zaire in the Sudan, to crowded cities and rainforests in Brazil, to nomadic settlements in Pakistan, to the high-tech hot zone or level 4 lab of the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta. Their groundbreaking work has done much to add to the understanding of these dangerous viruses, which have confounded scientists and pose a real threat to humans. McCormick and Fisher Hawk tell their story in the new book, Level 4, Virus Hunters of the CDC, written with Leslie Allen Harvitz. They married a few years ago and are currently teaching at Aga Khan University Medical School in Pakistan. They said that to trace the path of these deadly viruses, you have to begin in Africa.
Ebola virus and Lassa virus appear to be members of families of viruses that are quite old. You find members of both families of these viruses on different continents. However, you find multiple members in Africa, and one would have to guess, given the fact that Africa seems to be somewhat the cradle of biology, that it's likely that these viruses originated there. But they went to other continents a very long time ago. So these viruses have been around undoubtedly before human beings were around, and have co-evolved with the various species of animals and insects that act as their reservoirs.
Well, Susan, let me ask you about Ebola and Lassa, because I'm curious about how that got transmitted from animals to humans, whether it had to do with a bite or airborne transmission or eating the animals. Do you know how that happened, how that occurred?
We are pretty sure that what you have to do to infect yourself with either these viruses is to inoculate them either under your skin or rub them into an open cut or abrasion or rub them into your eyes, the mucosa of the eyes, or maybe inside the mouth. We're pretty sure that if you do that with these viruses, you will infect themselves. So imagine a situation where you have somebody, a poor person working either in the forest or a woman in the house with cuts on her hands, and there are rodents running around. And sometimes, for instance, in the villages, they have no electricity. So when they finish their evening meal, they will put the remains of the food under the bed, and the rodents will have a feast all night, and in the morning, the woman washes up. And at that time, she may very well get urine on her hands and infect herself. With Ebola, we just don't know, because we don't know what the source is. If we knew what the source is, then I could give you some hypothetical situations. With Crimean Congo, which is just as nasty a disease and more widespread, it's a little bit easier to describe what happens, because it's a tick bite. And the tick itself is infected on an animal which has the virus in its blood and ingests the blood with the virus, just rather like malaria and mosquitoes. This tick will then bite a human and transmit the virus. So that's a little bit simpler.
Do you feel like you're at war with these viruses?
I think that in a sense we all are. We're constantly at war with the organisms that surround us, that can infect us, and particularly for those organisms that can be transmitted from one person to another. When we see what's happened in the last four or five decades, we see more people who are going out into the forests, rainforests, but not only in South America, but in Africa and Asia, coming in contact more and more. More frequently with the ecological the ecological environment that these forests have, and they're encountering these new viruses. In addition to that, we have people, large numbers of people who live very close together in cities, and they're able to transmit the virus one person to another in many instances. And so we as human beings are going to have to become more and more aware of this, and I believe we're going to have better surveillance and a better system for being able to respond to these situations when we see them.
Susan, much of your work, both of your works really have been in countries in Africa, and I know that you're doing work in Pakistan now. Do you think people living in the so-called developed world, in countries like the United States, should be concerned about Ebola viruses in Zaire and fear some kind of contagion because of that?
I think they should be concerned. I think that to have a high level of fear is probably unnecessary and unwarranted. Some of these viruses have relatively long incubation periods, so it's quite possible for somebody in a remote area to get infected, to get on a bus, get to the city, buy an airplane ticket, and arrive in the United States. And we describe an episode like that in the book, which really did happen. A man came back to Chicago from Nigeria with Lassa fever, and he died of it in Chicago. So that can certainly happen. However, I think that provided we are well-educated ourselves in the United States, understand what our physicians understand what these diseases look like, ask the right kinds of questions of the patients, we ought to be able to identify and handle the patients both safely and well, and hopefully let them also survive. I think, though, in the general sense, that we should be concerned about all the possibilities of viruses emerging from poor countries, not just viruses, but also bacteria, and bacteria that are resistant to antimicrobials, because there are a lot of people out there, and a lot of people are also infected. And this allows organisms to change, to become more pathogenic, to evade antimicrobials, and to spread. And unless we pay attention to the conditions of people in poor countries, we're not going to be able to stop this happening.
I'm curious, with these very severe viruses, the Lassa viruses and the Ebola viruses, because they are self-limiting, is it possible, do you think, to have an enormous plague? Joseph?
I think that given today's circumstances, I don't think it's likely. I think it's very unlikely to have this kind of plague. I think what is far more likely is the kind of plague we see with HIV. But since the diseases with Ebola and Lassa and Crimean Congo that we've talked about, even Hantaan virus, which we know now in the United States, these are such dramatic diseases, and we understand them sufficiently well that when we see a cluster of cases, we know how to deal with them. We know how to stop the transmission. Where we would fail is if we had another virus like HIV, where we didn't see anything for a very long period of time while it was being transmitted silently from one person to another. We have such a virus that occurs here in the United States that would appear to be occurring at fairly high levels of transmission, for example, in Asia, and that's hepatitis C. Mm. It's a silent disease. It has a long incubation period like HIV and causes end-stage liver disease, and we're seeing very high levels of transmission in at least in Pakistan.
Joseph, I know that you were instrumental in isolating the oldest HIV strain. Is it still important to know where HIV came from?
Well, I think I think it's important to understand how this all happened. I don't think it's important in trying to blame anyone or point any fingers at anybody. I don't think that's a useful exercise. But I think it's important to have some perspective about how this happened. In this particular instance, what we wanted to know is, could we find any evidence that would support our hypothesis that HIV could circulate at very low levels in rural populations without the kind of epidemic disease that we're seeing in the cities? And so we were fortunate enough to have a collection of serum that was that we obtained during the outbreak of Ebola in very remote area of northern Zaire in 1976. We went back to look at those and found that we had less than 1% of the people that we took blood samples in 1976 had, in fact, antibodies to HIV. And from one of those, we actually isolated the virus. And that still remains, to my knowledge, the oldest virus that we have. Perhaps more importantly, we were able to go back to that same exact area and resample those villages 10 years later. And when we did that, we found, lo and behold, that the level of HIV was completely unchanged. It was exactly the same as it was 10 years before. Now, this is one of those areas that is remote, and this is partly the basis. We have some other evidence from a remote area of Sudan that's very similar. And this is part of the evidence that I think is supportive of the fact that the virus was able to persist, but at very low levels. And given its long incubation period, it didn't need to have high rates of transmission. And it was only when people began to move and change their behavior that we started to see the kind of problem we see today.
Well, I'm talking today with virologist Joseph McCormick and Susan Fisher-Hawk, and they have collaborated on a book called Level 4, Virus Hunters of the CDC. CDC standing for Centers for Disease Control. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Drs. Joseph McCormick and Susan Fisher-Hawk, and their book is called Level 4, Virus Hunters of the CDC. How do you work in the field? And we've been talking about AIDS and Lassa and Ebola and some of the other more dangerous viruses. When you're working in a place like Africa or perhaps in Pakistan or other countries around the world where you have set up labs, what do you bring with you, and where do you begin your investigation? Joseph, let me put that to you.
Okay. Well, if you're going into a fairly remote area, which we often do, we try to take those things which are absolutely essential. It's a little bit like backpacking. You take those, you try to know what you need and take only that which you need, because usually your means of conveyance are limited and you don't want to be overburdened.
So what we take are
the materials to make a diagnosis if possible in the field. Now that has often meant in the past taking a what's called a fluorescent microscope, which is kind of a special form of a microscope, and some reagents, slides, some solutions in bottles, pipettes, and other things that you need to set up and run your laboratory. Obviously, all this depends on having some kind of source of electricity. Now, if you're going to an area that has no electricity, then you're even going to be more limited in what you will do. And in those situations, often you will try to do the public health that's needed, but try to leave the diagnostic part and the other scientific part to later. And so you collect specimens and store them, and almost always, no matter where we go, we would take a tank, a specially made tank that's like a vacuum flask, and we put liquid nitrogen inside of it. That liquid nitrogen will keep viruses cold and preserved for many, many days. And this allows us to go into even the most remote areas, collect material, blood specimens or other tissues or even environmental specimens where we might want to try to isolate virus, keep them preserved and take them back to a laboratory, a level 4 laboratory very often, where we can work with them more efficiently and certainly more safely.
What do you do to protect yourself?
Well, when you're in the field, you obviously want to carry things like gloves, and we usually carry these paper or plasticized gowns. We carry masks. Some people use the respirator masks. Other people will use just the plain sort of surgical masks. One of the things we always do is to examine patients, to take care of them. We collect specimens. We don't back away from doing that.
Well, I know in the Sudan in 1979, you got poked with a needle after inserting it into a woman you suspected had the Ebola virus.
I was lucky on that. When I stuck myself, I was kneeling down in a dark hut with my colleague Roy Barron holding a kerosene lantern over me, and I was trying to take a blood specimen from this elderly lady who was who had a very high fever and was delirious. And indeed, I stuck myself, which made me very angry at myself more than anything else. But it also certainly was frightening, and I had to make a decision. Was I going to leave, or was I going to wait and see what happened? I made the decision that if I left, that the investigation would have to come to a halt. And I wasn't sure she had Ebola, although she was mixed in with a group of patients, most of whom did have Ebola. But I was lucky. She did not develop antibody to Ebola, and she recovered, which said to me that she didn't have Ebola.
I'm curious, once you have gathered some of these viruses in the field, and I assume that the next step is to transport them to some kind of laboratory, a level 4 lab, what do you do to make sure that these deadly viruses are going to be safe in transport?
You enclose them in a vial that you can seal, which you then put in another vial that you can seal. and you pack them in, this is plastic, not glass, you must not use glass, and pad them very carefully. And just make sure that everything is double leak-proofed at least. And usually we go triple leak-proofed. Next thing you have to do is make sure that they're preserved correctly, which is why we drop them into liquid nitrogen. And those tanks are also very solid. So when they're in transport, certainly from the field to the level 4 lab in say, in the U.S., they're in a pretty impregnable wrapping. We don't have very many concerns at that point.
Susan, I'd like to have you describe for us what a level 4 lab looks like. And of course, we're talking about a lab at the CDC.
You work within a space suit, which for reasons which are unclear to me is a sort of baby blue.
And it has, what do you want, pink?
Well, I don't know. I guess baby blue is better than pink. And you have a big plastic visor over your face so that you've really got pretty good all-round vision. The suit has pipes in it which air condition your head and your arms and your legs and even your back. You have to understand your own personal suit pretty well to keep it in good working order. You put it on and you hook yourself up to some air, and then you have to go through a series of self-locking sealing doors through an airlock into the lab itself. And then you go from airline to airline, usually seeing how far you can get without changing, because we all get a little bit lazy, particularly as we get more experienced. But inside there, you can do most anything in some comfort and considerable level of safety. I've never, working in that lab at CDC, I've never had any serious worries.
Well, since you're working with these very deadly viruses, are you the kind of person who gets imaginary symptoms or phantom symptoms?
Nope.
You said that without a pause.
No question about
no
that.
Question.
That's really funny because I've had, in the days when I was running the Lassa Fever Project out in Sierra Leone, I had many young folks who came through the system for working out there for shorter periods of time. And inevitably, they would come in and say, I think I have a sore throat. Boy,
sure.
My throat is really sore. Do you think I could have Lassa Fever? So this is a common occurrence.
Well, Susan, you said nope very quickly. How about you, Joseph?
No, I'm not. In fact, the 3 or 4 days I have to tell you after I stuck my finger, those were the days if I were going to have imaginary symptoms, I would definitely have started having imaginary symptoms. And I'm sure I had some, but I was able to rationalize myself into knowing that, in fact, I was not becoming ill.
Both of you have been working for some time now trying to understand and corral, I guess, some of these more deadly viruses. Where are you in that hunt, in that discovery, and what questions are you looking to answer? And Joseph, let me get an answer from you.
Well, I think that we still have a ways to go. In fact, quite a long ways to go. The encouraging things that have happened is it would appear that at least some of these diseases are amenable to treatment with a particular antiviral drug called ribavirin. It looks like probably Hantan is somewhat amenable to this drug. Certainly Lassa virus, and more recently been working with Crimean Congo hemorrhagic fever. And certainly the initial studies, but we're a long way from completing those, are encouraging. So that's a positive note. On the other side, we still are a long way from understanding where Ebola lives in its natural environment and what it is that spreads it to humans. But perhaps more importantly, we are a long way from being able to control the diseases that are more prevalent. And by the way, Ebola is probably the least prevalent of most of these diseases. The most prevalent ones are Lassa and Hantan virus, Hantan infection, which occurs throughout the world. And we are a long way from knowing how to control those. These are rodent-borne diseases, and quite frankly, we go back to the issues we were talking about earlier, and that is the social and economic conditions, because much of the transmission occurs among poor people who live in rural areas who simply don't have adequate housing and are uneducated about how to prevent contact with these rodents. And that really is the, as far as I'm concerned, the crux of the public health issue. So on the treatment side, we've made some progress. We've not made a lot of progress on the vaccine side, I think in large part because there hasn't been much funding for this. I mean, the number of people who work on these viruses, with the exception of HIV, is pretty minuscule. And with this number of people and the few facilities that are available, it's hard to make progress very rapidly. And I think I think this is an area where some more resources would be very helpful. And I think these resources I'd like to see them spread out both in the United States and in other parts of the world, because I think we need more facilities in many different areas.
Joseph McCormick and Susan Fisher-Hawk have collaborated on a new book, Level 4, Virus Hunters of the CDC. This is Fresh Air.